Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Janie Lee Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quit lit authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. It's been a good week here in the UK. It's been kind of sunny, and we're gearing up now, of course, to Easter weekend. So it's a long holiday, and the weather is really, really nice. So, yeah, it's been really good wherever you are listening in the world. I hope things are good for you. It's been very interesting in the press as well this week. There has been a couple of people come out as sober this week in the UK, which of course always makes the news. Susanna Reid, who is a TV presenter in the UK, very well known, working with Piers Morgan on TV on a breakfast show, has said that she has given up the booze and she feels so much better. There's quite a lot of talk about her skin and how she feels that her skin is so much better than it used to be. She's lost, I think it said, a couple of stone in weight. Sorry, I'm not doing that in the correct money, as it were. But anyway, she's lost a lot of weight. She feels brighter, sharper, you know, all of this. So it was a really interesting piece across a lot of the press. And then a lot of other mags picked up on it and said, how come alcohol is so bad on your skin? And you know, there's been a few articles picked up on that. But what was interesting in the piece was that she does say she still finds social situations difficult, because alcohol is this kind of social bridge, this social glue, if you like, that binds us together. And then right at the very end of the article, she says something like, I haven't got it in front of me, but she says something along the lines of that she's read that scientists are developing a form of alcohol. They're working on a form of alcohol that doesn't give you the hangover effect. And so she's kind of holding out, waiting for that worst side effect. And I thought, what a shame. Why not just focus on all these benefits? Why would you be kind of hanging on, waiting for the poison to come, you know, even if it doesn't give you a hangover? And similarly, the other very big story this week in terms of sober celebs is Anne Hathaway, and the headline in one of the papers was, I drank so much my hangovers lasted 5 days and I had to give up for my son's sake. And she's spilling the beans on what happened for her going out drinking with her Hollywood mates, binge drinking, and then ending up, as she says there, with long hangovers. And she says in this piece, I'll never be that person who can nurse a glass of wine throughout an entire evening. Well, me and her both, you know, she's recognised that she doesn't have the off switch. But again, this is the bit of the story that I couldn't get my head around. She says, she talks about her 3-year-old son, and she says she's vowed to be teetotal until he turns 18. Now, Anne, come on, if you're listening, which is highly unlikely. Seriously, your son is 3. And you're going to be counting the days and the years till he's 18. I don't think so. I think, you know, hopefully, with any luck, you'll be really, really happy very soon as to what an amazing decision you've made. I think this is the thing that I love reading about celebs and everyone, really. I love being inspired by people's stories. But I do think there's this kind of thing that people sometimes, it's the fear of missing out, isn't it? You know, the FOMO or fear of missing alcohol, FOMA, perhaps it's that there is just this kind of hanging on to the old days, as it were, that can be so, it can be so easy. I'm not trying to be judgmental in any way. I absolutely know that it can be incredibly difficult for some people to make this decision in the first place, to get past however many day ones, to go through all the firsts, whether it's the first wedding, the first birthday, the first Christmas, the first holiday. I'm well aware of all of that. But I just think, and also I absolutely agree And I do think it's a great idea to set yourself a challenge at the start. So absolutely say, OK, I'm going to do this for 3 months or I'm going to do this for 6 months, whatever it is. That does make sense. But to plan to do it for 15 years and then go back to it. Well, I sincerely hope that she, by then, well, hopefully very soon, she'll realise that actually the truth of it is alcohol, you don't gain anything. It only takes away. You really don't gain anything at all. And I think once you can, you know, just grasp that, once your mindset can change, it really does make an absolutely massive difference. And I think one thing that helps hugely with that mindset change, is to really gen up on everything to do with alcohol. So that's the inspiration, you know, and that's what I'm hopefully bringing you with this podcast. And of course, there are many other fantastic podcasts, so many great books. And I think that inspiration of hearing other people's stories, hearing all these different takes on sobriety or mindful drinking is really going to give you fuel. It's really going to give you support. And I think this is incredibly difficult to do on your own, particularly the way society is. So the more support you can get and the more you can be inspired, the better it is. And when you can just click that, when that mindset, you know, shift comes into place, it really does open up a whole new world. And one of the ways that was opened up for me was in reading the various Quitlet books and the various books and learning more about alcohol. It's not just about reading other people's stories and finding what worked for them, because of course it's different for everybody, but actually getting to grips with the drug itself. That was a big one for me. And I know I've shared this before on the podcast, the fact that I, you know, it seems bizarre now, but I didn't really get just how addictive alcohol is. I didn't really understand the substance. I just thought it was me, and that everybody else, you know, most other people were absolutely fine, unless they weren't, unless they were completely rock bottom. But I had no idea of the spectrum, if you like, of how much people drink, and I certainly didn't grasp the real facts about alcohol. I mean, it's not surprising, I suppose, because look at how it's portrayed to us as fabulous and glamorous and colourful and literally the key to everything and the thing that will make you popular and beautiful and all of that stuff. But you know that we're fed from a very young age. But of course, it's an illusion. I remember from last week. I hope you enjoyed the podcast last week. By the way, I got some great responses to the podcast from Scott, the boy who drank too much. And I remember during his interview, he said that he started drinking something like 16, I think he said, and now he's having sobriety is meaning that he's having to learn all over again who he is, you know, getting in touch with who he really is as a person. So it's fantastic that you know, we can get this inspiration from just from all these amazing sober heroes, really. It's fantastic. Today is no exception, because my guest is someone who really helps us with this whole mindset, with working out exactly what alcohol is. And his book was hugely helpful for me. I'm talking, of course, about William Porter, and the book is Alcohol Explained. It's such an excellent book. I mean, this guy has, you know, research doesn't cover it. He really, really has done his research. He's literally explained things in such a kind of basic way, really. You know, it's almost simplistic, but actually, as you start going through the book, you're constantly going, wow, I kind of see what you mean. I hadn't seen it that way. I really didn't realize that was the case. You know, which is amazing. Right, before I go any further, and before I play the interview that I did with Sam, which is his real name, we'll get onto that. I want to apologize to anybody who listened to the podcast last week when it was first uploaded. It always drops on a Friday. And anyone who listened to it on Friday or Saturday, you didn't get the full thing. I'm so sorry. And I would love you to go back and listen again, because you literally, if you did tune in on Friday, only would have heard just exactly the interview with Scott. None of my chat before or my chat after. And importantly, you wouldn't have heard my interview with Mike from Jeffrey's Tonic. Mike is the CEO of a fantastic drinks brand called Jeffrey's Tonic. And that interview went out last week. So I'm just going to beg you to go back and listen again to that episode, the episode that features the boy who drank too much. Even if you just listen to the beginning and Mike's interview and then the end, it would be lovely to have you hear that. And just a reminder for anybody who did listen in and for whatever reason can't listen again, the interview with Mike was all about tonic water. And we think about tonic water. And of course, now, you know, we have different tonic waters, don't we? And some are sweetened with artificial sweetener. We had a long discussion on that. It's worth listening to the interview for that, because Mike, along, you know, just like I do, has very strong views about artificial sweeteners, really doesn't like them at all. But these Jeffrey's tonics are unique in that they're tonic syrups, and these are made with original herbs and spices. So, you know, we discussed how so many other drinks on the market, particularly, you know, juices and cordials and so many of these kind of drinks, don't have fantastic ingredients in them. They have not just sugar, but, you know, flavorings and all sorts of nonsense. And, you know, he was saying, yes, it is more expensive, but they've just got the most fantastic, you know, real flavors, you know, proper flavors, you know, organic Sicilian lemon juice. That's one of them. And they use a very special process. So it's a really lovely balanced drink, and you can just have it kind of with some ice, or you can mix it with some sparkling water. It's so nice. I tried just last night, I tried the original syrup, as they call it. I just had it with some sparkling water. It's got cassia, nutmeg and allspice in it. So it's a proper grown-up drink. Really seriously good. So anyway, go back and have a listen to that interview and check out the brand. It's jeffreystonic.com. And there will also be some Jeffrey's tonics to give away on my website on imperfectlynatural.com. So do go and have a look there, and we'll be uploading that competition very, very soon. I will also remind you about our event, which is on Monday, 29th of April. It's in London. It's at the Jago. This is a free event. It's organised by the charity My Yard. But you do have to book your tickets. So you need to go to Eventbrite and just type in My Yard, or you can type in the title of the event, which is Self-Care for the Sober Curious. And we have Laura Willoughby as our guest from Club Soda. We're an online community, of course. I have done a podcast with Laura. She's so knowledgeable and has so much experience across everything to do with sobriety and alcohol-free living. She organises the Mindful Drinking Festivals. So there really isn't much that Laura doesn't know. And then my other guest, just confirmed last week, is William, who is my guest today. So it's going to be such a treat if you're able to make it. We're going to have some kombucha there for you to taste if you haven't tried it before, and some other alcohol-free drinks, some vegan nibbles. It's at the Jago at 7 o'clock, Monday, 29th of April. Get your tickets on Eventbrite. And it would just be fantastic to meet some of you there. We're going to have some a couple of raffle prizes as well. So we won't ask you for any money, but if you did want to take part in the raffle as a donation to My Yard, we've got some very cool things to give away. Just jacking those up now. We've got some nice drinks from the Wise Bartender, alcohol-free drinks. And we've got a gorgeous set from Tabitha James Cran. So gorgeous organic hair care set. Because let's face it, once you decide to stop drinking, you might have a little bit of extra money, or you might just want to treat yourself. to something nice. And that's the time when people often start thinking, wow, I might actually get my hair done, or I might treat myself to a facial, or whatever it is for you. So we've got some nice stuff from Tabitha James-Cran and Rock Sober, who were our guests at the last event, Lee and Sean. They've given us a lovely raffle prize as well, some Rock Sober branded goodies. So let's get to the interview then. Just to tell you a little bit about William's book, if you haven't read it, as I say in the interview with him, it's a really logical book. It's definitely not a memoir, you know. And I looked at the book and I saw that William had said that he said, when I wrote Alcohol Explained, I wanted it to be as short and concise as it reasonably could be. I couldn't cover everything because the book would become too long and unwieldy. I tried to include what I thought were the key points needed to get a good overall understanding of alcohol and alcoholism. And it was not an easy call to make. And even now, I'm far from sure I've struck the right balance. But that's as it may be. Now, I'm pretty sure that you can read the first five chapters free of charge. So, you know, after you've listened to this interview, do go and have a look at the book. It's, as I say, it's great to just nail the truth, really, the truth about alcohol. So it's William Porter, author of Alcohol Explained. Enjoy the interview.
Sam or William, whichever I should call you, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. I really, really appreciate it. Now, I know you've got a real job as well as writing a book. I've no idea how you fit everything in. But tell us a bit about your story and how you got started and how you wrote this amazing book, which has changed so many people's lives.
To be honest, it came about, I suppose, going right back to the beginning, was when I was in my late teens. So this would be back in the 90s, and I was smoking, so I was sort of looking for a way to stop smoking, and I came across Alan Carr,
yeah,
and his smoking book, and I became quite fascinated. To be honest, it didn't stop me smoking immediately, but it really opened my eyes to kind of understanding, I suppose, addiction, and in particular the drugs that we almost don't think of as drugs. We just think of them as social pastimes. And I sort of started becoming more and more interested in it. And over the years, obviously, I was drinking anyway, and my drinking sort of became heavier and heavier. And I suppose I just sort of kept analysing and kept thinking around my drinking and sort of adopting that approach to trying to analyse and understand it.
At that point, can I just ask you quickly, were you already aware of, you know, the importance of mindset and how the brain works? Or was this all sort of quite new to you?
No, it was all fairly new to me, to be honest. It was almost like, for me, it was like taking a first step on like a fuller understanding. And it took, I suppose, years, because I, as I say, it was in my late teens when I sort of developed that initial interest, if you like. And I didn't get round to writing Alcohol Explained for like a good 20 years after that.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a long time. So it was, I didn't set out with any intention to write about it. I just set out, well, I suppose I'm just sort of naturally inquisitive, as many people are, and just sort of looking to understand what was going on more than anything.
Yeah. And then when you made your decision to stop drinking then, which I assume you did at some point over those years, how easy or difficult was it for you, given that you had this knowledge, this sort of awareness of mindset?
It made it easier, and it made it, for me, it made it certain. I knew I was going to quit. I suspected I would struggle with parts of it, for example, the socialising or the rest of it, but I knew it would make it definite. And interestingly enough, the order it happened in is that I quit, and then it was after that that I thought about writing about it and writing about my understanding of alcohol and how it all works. And actually, and this was an unintended consequence, I found that writing about it actually sort of filled it in and solidified it for me. So it actually helped my understanding. I know there's a saying that if you want to truly understand a subject, you need to teach it, because that sort of really draws out your knowledge. But for me, it was writing about it that really solidified it, because I think it helps for you to set it out in a, you know, like a codified
logical manner.
I also then realized that there were some gaps, because when I came to set it out, a few of the bits didn't quite add up. And that, so I think it was phenomenally helpful for me as well.
Yeah. I mean, what's been great about your book for so many people is there isn't too much sort of emotional stuff in there, so you haven't really got much of a memoir or much fluff at all, actually.
No.
It's really very logical, and as the title suggests, you really do uncover addiction and what alcohol is. And I've said this a few times on the podcast, but I'm always sort of slightly amazed at myself when I have to admit that I didn't actually realize that alcohol was addictive. I know that's a bizarre thing to say, but I didn't really realize the nature of the beast, as it were. So just tell us a bit about that, and how you just tell us a bit about alcohol itself before we even get on to the addictive nature or addictive patterns.
Yeah, certainly. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, and to be honest, I think what you've said is probably represents a view sort of 90% of society, because people don't think of it as being addictive. We kind of think it's fairly benign and fun.
Yeah.
And a very small, unusual percentage of the population that are alcoholics, they're addicted to it.
Exactly. But it's their problem. It's not the alcohol. Yeah.
So for everyone else, it's perfectly safe. But so alcohol itself is a chemical depressant. And when I'm using the term depressant, I'm using it in its strictly chemical sense as something that inhibits or reduces nerve activity. So that's essentially what it does. And that's also why it's poisonous, because obviously in greater doses, it just stops all nerve activity. And that, by its very definition, is death. But we generally imbibe it in smaller quantities so that it has a sort of a dampening effect on our feelings, hence us feeling slightly more relaxed after having an alcoholic drink. But obviously the point there is, and this brings us into the addictive nature of it, the brain isn't a passive object. It doesn't just sit there and do nothing. It tries to, it has its own array of chemicals and hormones and drugs that it releases at the right times and in the right quantities to keep us ticking over and generally mentally healthy and happy. So what alcohol does, because alcohol is a depressant, the brain tries to counter the depressive effects of the alcohol by essentially, it's a fairly complicated chemical process, but what it actually does is to sort of raise our anxiety and stimulation levels to try and counter the depressive effects of the alcohol. So obviously when the alcohol wears off, we are then left in an overly anxious state, and that's... people are becoming more aware of that now, and you see a lot of things about hangxiety, which is the hangover and the anxiety. Mm. But that's essentially what it is. It's the brain trying to counter the depressive effects of the alcohol so that when the alcohol wears off, you're in a sort of an overly sensitive, overly anxious state.
Yeah. And of course, we've read so much recently about the link between alcohol and mental health. It's, yes. they're intrinsically linked, aren't they? But we're on that, on that note, then, why is it that we can, that many of us can sort of drink happily, in inverted commas, for quite a lot of years before things sort of tip up for us? Because we do seem to increase our tolerance level, don't we? It's almost as if our body is very cleverly designed to adapt to whatever poisons we're throwing at it, and most of us can be relatively well. I mean, I certainly had no idea that. It's only now I look back I realized how impaired I really was, but I was very much functioning. Nobody else would know that I was drinking. I never missed a day of anything. But clearly it was doing damage to my body. So I'm not even quite sure what my question is, but I'll just throw that one at you, because it does appear that we gain quite a tolerance to it, most of us, but then something tips up, and then I'm sure it's different for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. So the tolerance is an interesting thing, because when you talk to people in terms of sort of the alcohol withdrawal and that everybody gets it to a greater or lesser degree, some people struggle with that concept, but actually it's intrinsically linked to tolerance. Because then if you say to someone, well, everyone will appreciate that when you start drinking, you may be able to have one or two drinks, whereas 10 years down the line, you can comfortably have three or four times that amount. And that's what we think of as tolerance. But actually, then if you say to someone, well, what is tolerance? That's something a lot of people haven't really thought about. And what it actually is, it's your brain's ability. And it's exactly goes back to what you were saying about you can keep poisoning yourself, but your body essentially wants to survive. Yeah. If you're constantly antidepressant in, your brain becomes more and more proficient at countering the effects of it,
yeah.
which has two results. One, you can drink more, and that's what we think of as tolerance. But of course, the downside of it is when the alcohol wears off, the withdrawal becomes increasingly severe.
Yeah.
So if when you start drinking, you have one glass of wine of an evening, the withdrawal from that is going to be equivalent to the alcohol in that one glass of wine. But if you're having three or four glasses of wine, the withdrawal is equivalent to those three or four glasses of wine, and it's increasingly severe. Mm. The other thing I think to mention on the withdrawal, it makes us just feel slightly out of sorts and slightly anxious, and it's not entirely different from when you drink too much coffee, for example, and you feel slightly jittery. It's not a particularly pleasant feeling. But most of the time, people don't associate it with the alcohol. Mm. So for many years, you can go along, and as I say, one glass of wine is going to be almost imperceptible, that feeling of anxiety. So it takes a number of years for you to build up to such a level that it becomes noticeable and starts to cause you problems. Mm. And a lot of the time, people can drink to quite extreme levels, and they don't really associate that anxiety with a direct withdrawal from alcohol. They just think it's part and parcel of the hangover. Mm. They just think of themselves, they've gone out and they've drunk too much, they feel a bit ropey the next day, but they don't, that might be an element of it. They may feel nauseous and headachy, but that's entirely separate. What I'm talking about is that actual anxiety feeling that you feel.
Yeah.
So it takes years and years to get there. Now, many people, if they're living fairly comfortable and happy lives, their drinking tends to increase, but at a fairly short level. So many people can live and die without even realizing that that anxious feeling is the withdrawal the next day. But obviously, if you have a very stressful life, or if something suddenly happens to you that's quite traumatic, that then can essentially it just increases the pace at which your drinking increases.
Yeah, yeah. So that's very interesting then. So if we, with your research that you did into the way the brain works, the way the mind works, is there such a thing then as an addictive personality? Are there people who are prone to addiction, who are more likely to go down this path? Or do we all have the propensity, and is it possible for any of us to tip into that too much drinking, if you see what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that it's possible for anyone to become addicted. And if anyone doubts that, again, just to go back to tolerance, it's impossible to drink every day without building up a tolerance. And that tolerance is intrinsically linked to withdrawal, which is obviously the chemical side of the addiction. So absolutely, you could take absolutely anyone. And if you forced them or made them, or for whatever reason, have a certain number of alcoholic drinks each day and slowly increase that, which they would be quite comfortable to do because their tolerance would build up. On the other side, that withdrawal would correspondingly increase as well. So absolutely, we are all different on a molecular level, and some people, I think, can be more inclined to become addicted to things than others. Mm. But that's not their chemical makeup. Most of that is to do with how we deal with stress.
Yeah.
So if we get used to dealing with stress by going home and reading a book or doing some exercise or talking about it, if that's how we naturally deal with stress, then that's fairly healthy and normal. But I think the problem is a lot of us either smoke a cigarette or have a drink to relieve stress. And then when you stop smoking or stop drinking, your method of dealing with stress is to reach for, you know, a pill or a drink or something to make you feel better rather than doing something more positive. Mm. So I think when you get into that sort of habit, that can lead you to other addictions, because you try and cut one out and you go on to the next one. And what we're really looking for is some kind of stress relief.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's very true, isn't it? So many people do, even if they manage to come off alcohol, they then get a serious sugar addiction. That's exactly. A classic one.
Yeah, people tend to overeat or all sorts of things.
Yeah. What was the one of the most surprising things that you found in your own research?
I think for me personally, it wasn't so much the research, but it was the personal experience. And I think for all the research you do, the only way, and ultimately what we're doing, if people are thinking about quitting drinking, when you really break it down into its most basic, what you're doing is you're comparing life with alcohol compared to life without alcohol and what is better. Mm. And I think for me, the most surprising thing was how much better it is without alcohol. Mm. To such an extent, I think a lot of people that stop successfully look back on their drinking years and really can't understand why they bothered putting themselves through it.
Yeah.
And that was certainly true for me, in that it's surprising how much better things are without alcohol. And when I think when you start to understand it properly, that really comes into sharp relief. So I think for me, that was the main thing. But as I say, it wasn't necessarily a research thing. It's something you have to try and experience for yourself to really appreciate.
Yeah, no, I love that. I'm really glad you flagged that up. I mean, that's really the main sort of focus of what I'm trying to do. Because it, again, you know, I was one of those people that when I decided it was time to give up, it was a case of I have to give up. Not really. Mm. I want to. I have to. You know, I don't have a choice. I'm waking up at 3 a.m. I feel terrible. I have to give up. But it felt like a massive negative. I could never have imagined that life is better on the other side, which is why books like yours are so important. And, you know, Catherine Gray, that fabulous title, you know, The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober. It really is an unexpected joy. So the more people like us talk about that, you know, we can pass that across. Because when you're in those early stages, it can be very, very tough. Tell us about, you know, again, what you found out about the giving up process. I mean, am I right in thinking that the actual physical withdrawal is only, I don't know, is it up to 10 days or something, and maybe not even quite that much?
Yes, it is. It very much depends on how long people have been drinking for. And if it's very different for people who drink like me, because I only ever drank at weekends. I drank more weekends, but I would always have a few days off before I started drinking again. So the withdrawal then, even if you're drinking very heavily when you do drink, is much smaller.
Yeah.
But the withdrawal, if you're drinking a substantial amount every day and have been for years, it takes a lot longer, because essentially what you're doing when you're going through the withdrawal, the first stage obviously is the alcohol has to leave your system.
Yeah.
That's usually about 24, 36 hours. The real problem is after that, when the alcohol's left but that increased stimulant level is still there, and that's the real problematic phase, because that's the period where you can't sleep, because you're used to having however much alcohol to counter the stimulants to put you to sleep.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden without that, you find you're lying awake all night. Consequently, you can be very tired the next day. So essentially you need to get the alcohol out of your system. You then need to wait, and it can be anything for 3 to 5 days for the stimulants to sort of leave your system and for your brain to get back on a normal level. That's you through the worst of it. But if you're drinking a lot every day, it takes you quite a long time to get back into a normal sleeping pattern and then to catch up on sleep. And the problem is when people are drinking a lot every day, the stimulants required to counter the alcohol are inside them all the time. So when the alcohol leaves and the stimulants go, they feel extremely tired. So that's the next stage in the process, is you feel extremely tired, and that can last a few days as well. Generally speaking, sort of 8 to 10 days is normal, but it can go on for longer. And one of the things that makes it go on for longer is if, for example, you've got children and you're at work during the day, so that your time for sleep is shrunk down a bit. It can take you a lot longer to get on top of things, because one of the other things you need to do is to catch up on sleep a bit to start feeling back to normal.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. And of course, when you're at your weakest, in inverted commas, when all of that's going on, and you, because in many cases, most of us have been using that alcohol as a crutch. It's like, oh my goodness, I've had a hideous, stressful day. Kids are driving me mad. You know, let's open the wine. And that's the kind of the programming that we've all got used to, isn't it? So it really does take a different approach. And you know, and I love focusing on self-care and what we can do, the little things that we can do. But I wonder, and I'm sure you do talk about it in your book, these the fact that we can't sleep very well, the fact that our bodies need to kind of recalibrate. What would be your recommendations for people, apart from trying to get more sleep? Is there anything we can do sort of nutritionally that would help support that time where our body is, everything, the chemicals are all mixed up basically, aren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the best thing you can do is try and eat as much fruit and vegetables as you can, because they are the food stuff that contain the most vitamins and nutrients that we actually need. And one of the problems with alcohol is it inhibits absorption of things like zinc and B vitamins.
Yeah.
And some people take supplements, which is fine, but actually really just eating a healthy diet is probably the best thing you can do. The other thing that does help, if you possibly can, is to take some exercise, because that increases your mood anyway. Exercise improves people's mood. And also then it gives you the best chance of sleeping at night and having a proper night's sleep. And of course, the other thing with, the temptation is when you stop drinking, and you've already sort of alluded to it, is that you sort of think to yourself, well, I've quit drinking, so I can give myself a bit of a break with regard to food. So there's a tendency to eat lots of sugar and takeaways and all the rest of it. But that as well can disturb your sleep, because it's difficult to digest, and it then makes you hot during the night as you digest it. So actually, food-wise, my advice would be just to get as much fruit and vegetables as you can inside you.
And do you recommend that, I don't know whether you did this yourself, but do you recommend that people, particularly if, like me, you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel yet, should we, set ourselves a challenge and aim for, giving up for a 30 days or whatever it might be, is that a good process to tell our mind, okay, I'm just going to do this for 30 days and see how I feel?
I think there's a few things to say on that. I think it's certainly a good way of doing it for people if they're sort of almost sober curious and they're sort of sniffing around giving up drinking to see what it will be like. So I think if you're at the lighter drinking end of the scale, that's a very good way of doing it, because you're sort of taking a bite-sized chunk and almost dipping your toe in the water, if you like, to see how it is. The one thing I would say personally is I found things improved dramatically over the first few days and weeks, but I found some quite major changes happened after about 3 months.
Yes.
So I think people are setting periods, although it almost is counterintuitive, the longer you can do, the better, because some of the major changes come about quite later on. One in particular that I just wasn't expecting was I found my appetite changed completely at around the 3 month mark. And I found that I was eating completely different foods, not because I was trying to diet or anything. I just naturally changed what I fancied eating. I think one of the other slight problems with that is I think if people are stopping for sort of periods and saying to themselves, well, I'll go a week or a month or whatever, it's almost like a carrot and stick thing. They're almost like a donkey dangling a carrot in front of their noses and constantly, but that carrot is having an alcoholic drink at the end of it.
So you're which in a sense you're just perpetuating the fact that alcohol is something that you want, whereas in a sense what we're really saying is we're not giving up anything, what we're gaining with a better life. So why would you want at the end of 30 days another little bit of poison?
I think that really is the key thing, is that you need to go into it with the right mindset, which is that you're going to see what life is like without drinking. And I think if you treat it like a period of abstinence and you're really looking forward to just getting stuck back into it at the end of it, you almost defeat the point of it, because you're not concentrating on what you're gaining. You're just constantly waiting for those 30 days or 60 days or whatever to come up.
Absolutely.
Say, if you do give yourself a period, you do need to try and appreciate what life is like without drinking, and not just, sit there at your next social function, bored and angry and upset, waiting for your 30 days to be upset up so that you can drink again.
Sure. And what would you say to those people who have, cracked whatever it is, 30 days, or maybe it's 60, or maybe it's even 6 months, and then they've, relapsed, or whatever expression you want to call it, they've basically, something went wrong, they had a drink. There tends to be a culture of totally beating yourself up and saying, oh my God, I'm back to day one. What's your thinking around that?
I think there's two sides to it. On the one hand, there's no point beating yourself up over something. What's done is done, and that's all there is to it. I think you need to use it as a learning curve, because if you're still determined to stop, something has gone wrong. And what it usually is, you come to a certain situation, it might be Christmas, or you're going on holiday, or a family barbecue, or any one of those things, or a stressful situation has suddenly happened, you've had an argument, or someone's died, or whatever it is, you feel like you need a drink. And you need to use that as a learning curve. And you can do that in two ways. The best possible way of doing it, and it's usually sort of too late to do, but if you possibly can, you need to, when you take that drink, really concentrate on it and see what it's actually doing for you, and more in particular, what it's not doing for you. Because a lot of the time, it's the thought of drinking and not the reality of drinking that we use, and they're two very, very different things.
Yeah.
I think if you've stopped for a period, you return to drinking, if you can use that to solidify in your mind that no, drinking's not what you thought it was and not what you built it up as, it's actually the reality of it is something quite different, that can be hugely powerful, particularly if you're trying to quit again. So you can look on a failure, if you like, whatever you call it, a relapse, as actually a building block to take you on to a much more definite attempt in the next instance.
Yeah.
So I would say, on the one hand, there really is no point beating yourself up over it, but try and use it so that your next attempt is more certain to succeed.
Sure. No, I agree. So it's kind of identifying what the triggers were and identifying what it was that happened so you can prepare.
I think that's hugely powerful as well, because say, for example, I don't know, it's Christmas and you think, oh, I've stopped for 6 months, I can just have a drink on Christmas. Then having drunk and realise it wasn't what you thought it was, and actually you wish you hadn't drunk, you can then go through and think, right, next time, next year, how will I deal with it? And you can sit down for a few minutes and think about what it will be like at Christmas to not have an alcoholic drink, but to enjoy it anyway. You'll be sleeping better, you'll be fresher, you'll be enjoying the company more. And you can prepare yourself mentally for it. Because I think that's another thing. When people quit, they almost psych themselves up as much as possible and say, right, now I'm going to stop drinking. And then they sort of throw themselves into life and just hope that they get through each situation as it arises without drinking. Whereas actually, it's far better to think about the triggers in advance. So if you know you're going to the pub on a Friday, don't just wait till you got there and hope that you're going to resist the drink. Think very carefully and imagine what it would be like to go there and meet your friends and not drink. And think also about the positives, about how pleasant it's going to be able to drive home and sleep well and wake up refreshed the next day, and all the positives attached to it.
Yeah. What's been the main positives for you in your life?
It's, for me, it's feeling like I'm back in my teens. I feel better now in my 40s than I did throughout my 20s, to be quite honest, because I was, you know, hungover or tired from drinking, or I feel like I've knocked 15, 20 years off.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. It's that feeling of waking up in the morning, feeling refreshed and ready to go. And I genuinely thought, you know, when you hit 30, 40, you just didn't get that feeling anymore, and that was old age. And what I've actually discovered is, most of the time it's the drugs, recreational drugs we take, and to a degree our diet, that actually causes that feeling. It's not a natural feeling. And it's easy to go back to that feeling of waking up feeling refreshed and positive.
Yeah. And just back on this issue for a moment about mental health, because it just seemed that there's so much anxiety and you know, particularly with young people as well, there seems to just be, I don't know if it's just that we're talking about it a lot more, or whether there genuinely is, you know, far more prevalence of people with anxiety and mental health issues. I'm always cautious because I don't want to sort of say to people, okay, ditch the booze and then all of your mental health issues will go away, because it's not quite as simple as that. But in real terms, what difference can it make with some of the research that you've done?
So at a starting point, say you're fairly healthy mentally, so your chemical balances are all fairly, they balance all quite nice, and internally it's all fine. If you're introducing alcohol, you're playing around with that chemical balance, and when you stop, you will go back to normal and you'll go back to feeling fairly resilient and positive.
Yeah.
If you've got a mental health issue that, for example, is the cause of a chemical imbalance, you're only going to be exaggerating it and making it worse with alcohol. And you're quite right to say you need to be careful about saying stop drinking and you will be fine, because some people won't be.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, if the mental health issue is to do with some kind of chemical deficiency, human understanding of all the chemicals in the human brain is at its infancy. We don't know much about it. And when you're working with medical staff to try and rectify a mental health issue, it's trial and error. If you're involved, if you're talking about drugs to try and relieve that error, it's trial and error. It's very, very difficult, and it's a long process, because we can introduce a drug to maybe top up the level that might be low, but that can have unintended consequences because we don't really understand how all these drugs and hormones interplay with each other.
Yeah.
It can be quite a long process of trial and error. You're not going to be able to identify it properly if you're drinking, because your chemical levels are all over the place.
Yeah.
So you may have an issue that you need to address, but you have to ditch the booze first to be able to drill down and identify that what that error is. It's like, I don't know, if you've got like an accounting, like on Excel, and you've got loads of errors in it, having more than one makes it even more difficult.
You have to
get rid of one at a time to try and drill down. And equally, if it's not a chemical imbalance, if it's something that's happened to you, some kind of trauma, alcohol is constantly exaggerating it or dulling it and then exaggerating it when it wears off. And the problem is, with any kind of mental trauma, the only way to deal with it is to get to grips with it, to come to terms with it. And you may need counselling or whatever to do that. But when you're drinking, you're not coming to terms with it. You're just anaesthetizing it, burying it, and then it comes up twice as much the next day when the alcohol's worn off.
Yeah.
So again, you're not actually dealing with it. So you're quite right. Ditching the booze doesn't necessarily immediately make everything okay. Mm. But for people who do have mental health issues, it's the first necessary step to actually identifying and dealing with those issues.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I could chat to you for hours, William, Sam, but I really appreciate you taking the time, and I really love your approach, because, you know, it's very logical. I love the way that you really do kind of spell it out. And it's when you read the book, I can sort of almost visualize you kind of going off and going, oh, I wonder about that. So it's obviously a very heartfelt thing, because I mean, I was amazed to find out you aren't, it's not as though you're a doctor or a scientist even particularly, is it? You really took this logical approach.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was, to me, some people say the book's not quite scientific enough, but to me it was almost, it's writing it in terms I understand it. So I think when you talk about the real, like, non-adrenaline and the beta receptors and all the rest of that, kind of leaves me a bit cold. I kind of talk of it in terms I understand it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what's your sort of aim for the future then? I mean, will you be writing more books? Have you got any other work planned in this arena? Because clearly people, you know, love hearing your take on things.
Yeah, I think so. So I've done the alcohol book, and I've done the diet and fitness book now.
Seen that one. What's that one called?
Okay. Yeah, no, I've done a diet and fitness book. So that's looking around. I'll have to send you a copy of that.
Yeah,
so
please do. Great.
And so I'm sort of working on a smoking book at the moment.
Okay, which is fantastic.
Yeah, slightly ambitious, bearing in mind all of Alan Carr's work on it.
Yeah.
And it's in fairly early form at the moment, so I'm almost sort of dabbling in it to see if it goes anywhere rather than it being too firm.
Yeah.
So that's things
fantastic
at the moment.
Well, William, Sam, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. The website is alcoholexplained.com, is that right?
That's it, yes. Yep.
And the book is Alcohol Explained, and it's by William Porter. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
And as William says there, Diet and Fitness Explained, his new book, since we did that interview, I've got a copy of it. It's so good. It is, you know, rather like the alcohol book, very straightforward. He doesn't mess about at all. And I kind of thought there wasn't very much I didn't know about nutrition and fitness. I've been kind of in this arena for so many years. But still, I'm reading this book and there are little light bulbs going on, you know, where I think, oh my goodness, I've never thought about it that way. He makes so many really interesting points just about how our our mindset works when around food, because of course it can so often be the case that when people have given up drinking, they kind of take up another addiction, and that's often sugar or eating too much. And you know, let's face it, we can't give up food, can we? We have to eat. But it's a case of, what do we eat? And I would, by the way, still, as I've said before, I would still urge anyone who is, if not having an off switch is your thing and you're trying to stop drinking, don't try and confuse dieting at the same time. Even if you need to lose weight, I really honestly would say, don't try and do everything at once. It's enough. It's absolutely enough to focus on not drinking. Make that your priority, because it's so important. I would say do that first, but once you've got a little bit more headspace, you know, William's book is just great to just remind you of these basics, things we do already know, you know, how the digestive system works, why we need to drink water. Interestingly, he has a quite a unique take on how much water we should drink. He talks about salt in the book. He talks about vegan diets and the importance of eating, you know, plant-based foods, nuts, seeds, legumes. And again, it's all done from a very unemotional perspective, if you like. It really is just based on William's research, and you can tell that it's extensive. So yeah, highly recommend that one as well. So as we said before the interview, William is going to be a guest at Self Care for the Sober Curious, a free event, Monday 29th of April in London. Go to Eventbrite to book your ticket, your free ticket. Just type in Self-Care for the Sober Curious, or you can type into Eventbrite My Yard, which is the name of the charity who are organising this. I was thinking about self-care tips for today, and I saw a post on Instagram. Someone was suggesting that they were signing off for the Easter weekend, for the Easter break. And I thought, you know, I don't know if I can do that. I am as addicted as my kids. You know, there's another addiction for you, to being on my phone and on social media and all the rest of it. And it just got me thinking, I mean, maybe if I just did a day, it's better than nothing. And I also had a conversation this week with a friend who runs a glamping site, beautiful woodland glamping place. And there's no Wi-Fi in the woods at all. And she was saying how amazing it is when people come and stay, particularly families. And when they first arrive, you know, the kids are just incensed, absolutely incensed that there's no Wi-Fi, but within, I don't know, you know, a few hours, they're out building dens and having the most fantastic time. So I think it's probably a great reminder for all of us. She said they have this little phrase, you know, they say, there's no connection, but you'll make a much better connection. I don't think that's her phrase, but it's something like that. Basically, disconnect, and then you can reconnect with another part of yourself. So that is my self-care tip this week. And this is one where I'm pointing one finger at you as I say it, but I'm pointing three and a thumb back at myself, because I really need to do that this weekend. Actually, just switch off for a few hours and go and see the sea. That would be really nice. I hope I can get to do that, or go and walk through the bluebells. I'm hoping the bluebells are out in the woods not far from where I live. So whatever you're doing across this week and you know, this weekend and the rest of the week, have a wonderful time, and see if you can manage to switch off, even if it's only for a few hours. And I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Jamie Lee Grace. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us, share on social media, and tune in again.